Good evening. Welcome everyone, the time being 5:30pm. I will officially declare the meeting open. My name is Paula Eat. I have the honour of being the Mayor of Kingborough. Welcome to all the members of the public gallery who are with us here this evening and also to any viewers who are watching along at home on YouTube. I now officially declare the meeting open. Could I also just remind members of the public gallery to please, if you have mobile phones, make sure they're on silent throughout the meeting. A fun fact about today that I just wanted to share: today is the United Nations International Day of Happiness. So let's focus on creating a kinder world. And on that note, I have to tell you that today, sitting around this table, has been grade 3-4 St Aloysius classes, and they were very, very well behaved, and they set the tone. So, and they asked some very good questions. So a big shout out, some of them might be watching, so a big shout out to Mr Horn's class if you're watching. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website, and in accordance with council's policy, I will ask the general manager to confirm that the audio recording has started.
Confirm, Mayor.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reid, Deputy Mayor Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson, and Councillor Street is stuck in traffic and is a couple of minutes away. We have our General Manager, Mr Arnold, the Chief Financial Officer, Mr Breen, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Reeve, Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Dr Fox, our Manager of Environmental Services, Ms Quinn, our Manager of Development Services, Ms Tyler Moore, the Coordinator of Environmental Planning, Ms Den Exter, our Media and Communications Advisor, Ms Adams, our Communications and Engagement Support Officer, Ms Klein, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton. We have no apologies this evening. We turn now to the confirmation of minutes. The motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting No. 4, held on the 6th of March 2023, be confirmed as a true record. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried. Turning now to page 2, workshops held since the last council meeting. We had a workshop on the 14th of March, which covered the topics of roadside bushfire risk assessment and also emergency management. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest? No, thank you. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to move from closed into open session or open into closed session? Thank you very much. Still on page 2, questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public who's here this evening wish to ask a question without notice? So, thank you. If you could come up to the lectern and just state your name and the suburb which you live in, please.
Hello, Charles Biggins, Leslie Vile. I have a couple of questions that relate to the application of the Biodiversity Protection Code or overlay operating in this municipality. Is the council in the business of assessing the biodiversity value of private property in-house? Does council have the qualifications and professional indemnity insurance to be providing that kind of information or environmental service?
Thank you. Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, would like to take it on notice.
Thank you. We'll take that on notice. The next question, please.
In the instance that a DA is required, an environmental assessment... In the instance that a DA requires an environmental assessment, an independent assessment is commissioned by the landowner. Does council seek and a second opinion from another independent agency, or do they challenge the findings of the commissioned report from their own in-house environmental assessment?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, applicants are required to provide a report where their value is cited on site and the planning scheme has a requirement for it. The report needs to be written by a suitably qualified person We do a review of that report, and we have the professionalism within the team to be able to do the review if we think it's something that's contentious or out of the reach of the knowledge of the officers, then we can seek to get an independent report done where we deem that it's appropriate.
So the council doesn't challenge it in-house? Or they, or do they always use an external, a third party, second opinion?
Ms. Tyler-Moore.
Through you, may, you're using the word challenge. Yes, we may raise concern with content of a report or observations in a report or assumptions that are made. So, yes, we do that directly. We do not always seek independent review of that report.
I'm often told by clients, so I operate an arboricultural service, have done for the last 20 years in the Kingborough area. I'm often told by clients that council had ignored or overruled their commission report. How is this conflict resolved?
Ms. Tyler-Moore.
Through you, Mayor, we'd probably need to quantify what you mean by often, and some examples would be useful to be able to provide a response to the question. Of those, I wouldn't think that it's often. We need to consider the quality of the report and the content and whether it's meeting the needs of the planning scheme.
Thank you. My other questions regarding the LCZ land conservation zone values as discussed at last council meeting. There was some discussion about what those in some detail into what those values would be, and examples were given that open paddocks may have been characteristic of the area, or bushland may have been characteristic of the area, and these were the landscape values that would be that are attached to this zoning. I would like a little bit more light shed on those values. The landscape in Kingborough predominantly is a mixture of grasslands and bushlands. This is a ever-changing environment, so are we pinning the landscape values on what is presented today, or for example 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, completely changing environment. I would like a little bit more information on exactly if somebody's property is going to be zoned for landscape conservation. Is that based on what we see today? In other words, if our new tree grows, then that's changing the environment? No.
I think we've got the gist of your question. Thank you, Mr. Biggins. I'll ask Ms. Tyler-Moore.
Through you, Mayor. The comments that were provided at the last council meeting with respect to character and neighbourhood character or area character was a general comment about how it would be ascertained for each site. So the explanation was for the purpose of explaining to people that landscape conservation or landscape doesn't necessarily just mean a treed area, because some people believe that we mean trees only, we don't. It is that those values that we're lucky enough to have here in Kingborough, we have the combination of the types of vegetation or not native vegetation that you refer to, and it's often a combination. Many properties have some bushland and then other areas that are cleared that are more your paddock form or grasslands. We also acknowledge that there's modified bushland throughout the municipality, which is typical for any area where there is people moving into an area does change over time. So the question about what is the character that we're talking about, are we talking about 50 years, 100 years ago? No, because we certainly acknowledge that it changes over time. It would be unrealistic to go back all the way to the turn of time, otherwise we're only going to have native grasslands and bush areas. So it's more to do with what's present in the area at the time. But in saying that, there are also opportunities within the planning scheme to look at a preferred character, and many of the councillors would be aware and the public would be aware that for many of our areas, whether it be Kettering or Margate or Kingston, any of those, sometimes there's a preferred character and it's moving towards trying to improve areas. So if you can appreciate in an urban environment, as an example, we might say, okay, well, the suburbs like this now, there's no trees, there's no straight trees, it's the characteristic that nobody has trees or established gardens, but might be a preferred character to move more towards a character like Kingston Beach, if you like, which is fortunate enough to have very nice established gardens, which is a mix of native and non-native tree species. So there's a great big variety in what character means, and it depends on each application. So the explanation to people really was around you can't read the words too literally and assume what it means in each of those. We have the experience and we have the training to be able to interpret that for the different areas. So simply the question was, are we talking about the past or current or the future? I would say it's a combination between current and the future, and vegetation values and landscape values aren't just limited to the aesthetics, although that is a huge asset that Kingbra has. We have beautiful areas, we have great combination of areas, but obviously that vegetation offers habitat for fauna in the area as well, including a number of endangered species. So there is a combination in that, and certainly if we were to develop specific area plans for some of our areas, which is part of the new planning scheme, they do exist in the current scheme as well, but if we were talking about moving into the new scheme, we can have specific area plans that may include things like what we prefer to see as character in areas, and that may be revegetation, or it might be density or setbacks that achieve some of those preferred outcomes for space.
And again, if that body of knowledge, that those criteria that you're working towards, I gathered from last meeting that there was nothing actually written on that you're drawing on your extensive experience. The scenario that somebody might have a Federation home on a what is now predominantly bush block might think that the case might be put forward that the landscape aesthetic that would be most conducive to this property, like in a similar way that heritage zones work, that the clearing of land may be returning it to more of the aesthetic, the landscape conservation values associated with the other assets on the property. Is that a consideration?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Merson, if there's a property that has heritage values, it should be heritage listed. And it's not uncommon for heritage listings to incorporate the whole site, not just the building. So there's many examples where properties may have the gardens or the grounds listed or the stables and the sheds listed on them as well. So certainly that would be incorporated in consideration of future development of that site.
Outside of heritage values, is the age of the built structures there potentially indicating the landscape? If we have a 1970s house, do we look at 1970s landscape? Because Kingbra has literally changed 360 degrees since 1967. We had a vegetation cover here, predominantly grasslands, with 10 to 15% woodlands. Now it's completely reversed.
Thank you. I think I've got the gist of your question about the 1970s structure, Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, no, there is no required in the planning scheme that the presentation of a property needs to match the era of the house. So if it's a 1970s house, we don't ask for 1970s garden or landscape. It's not how it's done. You would only look at those sort of parameters if it was a heritage property or significant heritage around that, whether it's in the precinct or a neighbouring property possibly. But no, we don't couple era of house with what the landscape appeared at the time.
Okay then, so I'm quite concerned that the application of landscape conservation values is something completely discretionary, that it's just completely made up. There is such a wide range of landscape types that...
I hope you're going to frame this into a question very shortly.
Yes.
Please,
okay.
Mr. Biggins.
Can you please point to some sort of reference material that we're going to be using when considering these values?
Ms. Tarlemore.
Through you, Mayor, it's certainly not made up. It's not just applied as we just choose on the day. There is a methodology around that. There will be a supporting report that goes to the Planning Commission that explains and describes how that's been applied. We're required to, by legislation, to have that supporting report and information about how it's applied, and that will be available to the public during the public exhibition.
That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Biggins. Is there anybody else in the public gallery who'd like to ask a question? If not, thank you very much. We turn now to questions on notice from the public. We have three that were submitted. First one is in relation to residential development in a landscape conservation zone from Ms. O'Keefe, and an officer's response from Ms. Tyler Moore. The second one in relation to the same matter from Ms. Hanley, and a response from Mr. Stander. And a third one in relation to public parking for the Kingborough Community Hub from Ms. Leonard, and a response from Mr. Smee. If members of the public do wish to submit a question on notice, they can send it to us at kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. We come now to page 5, questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? Councillor Cordova, then Councillor Midgley, then Councillor Antoli. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I was very pleased to attend the Kingborough Community Forum on the weekend, and there was some very useful discussion around a number of things, but what I wanted to raise in this question was around the community hub fees for community groups being lowered, and also the idea of community groups receiving help with their public liability insurance. But specifically, my question is, there were some areas of discussion where it was clearly the purview of the state government, specifically when community groups want a particular area, the speed limit around that area changed, and it's a state growth road. So my question is, when community groups want something changed that falls within the purview of the state government, what can council do to help those community groups effectively lobby the state government? For example, can we help by coaching community groups on making effective submissions, or are there other strategies that we have in place to make sure that the voice of community groups is actually being heard beyond the reaches of our municipality and into the state government?
Thank you for the question, Councillor Cordova. Yes, it was an interesting discussion at the Community Forum on Saturday, and certainly I know there's a sense of frustration from a range of different community groups, particularly when it comes to their knowledge of local roads and wanting to change the speed limit. That's certainly been something that has caused concern when the state government refuses those requests, because ultimately if they're on any roads, they have to have the final decision. You may be aware, and we discussed it at the forum on Saturday, that we've recently put together an information sheet that is available on our website, which outlines the process for how you can lobby effectively to get a speed limit change. And certainly we'd recommend that community organisations have a look at that. Ultimately, the final say does rest with the Transport Commissioner in the Department of State Growth, but I do think it's also useful for community groups to directly lobby their local members of Parliament who are in government and who could advocate on their behalf. And I think in that case, and whether they be ministers or backbenchers, they're the people who have got the direct line into government departments, and so I think we should be encouraging people to and groups to do that. I know that as Mr. Reeve has been actively involved over many years with so many different requests for speed limit changes, and we go through the processes, we go through the community consultation, we provide the evidence from the, with the speed data and the other information we have, and quite often we can check all the boxes, but there is a refusal by the government to consider that. And that is very frustrating for many groups and for us as well, but I'd just encourage them to contact those people in state government that they think could be of use, but also then, you know, check in with councillors if we can provide any assistance as well. Next I had Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Sorry, just getting my questions up. I have a couple of questions here tonight, and I have sent them on to staff, some of them. The first one is in regards to Drew Point cycling signs. I was sent an email regarding at the Drew Point exercise, dog exercise area, there are signs on some of the entry gates to say no cyclists, but unfortunately families with several bikes quite often enter the dog park to cycle on its track, and this can be distressing for some of the dogs. So just wondering, can no cycling signs be put on all of the gates in the Drew Point dog exercise area to ensure that everybody's safe?
Mr. Smee, are you able to assist us with that?
Through you, Mayor, very short answer, yes.
Thank you, I'll reply.
We've made a decision.
Thank you very much. The next question is about Blackmans Bay poor water quality results. When you go for a walk as a councillor at local beach, you don't get to walk far some days. So lots of questions about this on the weekend. If we can just have some details and update regarding the poor water quality results. And I've also been informed regarding a sewage spill close to the beach. If I could please have more information about this.
I'm sure Ms. Quinn will be able to assist us with that one.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. Yes, unfortunately, we have had some poor results again at Blackmans Bay. It's been really good for across most of the summer that most of our beaches have been really good, but over the last few weeks, Blackmans Bay has failed a couple of the recreation water sampling events. So it had a both in the middle part of the beach and the southern part of the beach. So in the middle of the beach, it failed just before the recent long weekend, and the retest failed as well, and signs were then put up across the middle of the beach to advise people that the water quality wasn't good for swimming, and across social media and our website, etc. And then after the long weekend, the signs were taken down and the retest was good again. Last week, the southern end of the beach failed, which hadn't failed for a very, very long time. So that had a failure of around 500, which is the we need to retest again. So retested again, it came in just under needing to advise. So still had a moderate result. That would be better if it was much lower than that. So ongoing all through summer, our stormwater investigations officer is in the catchment. He's probably in Blackmans Bay most days, I would think, and knows that catchment very well. He's looking through our stormwater system to look for any leaks. He's talking to Taswater. So in both of those, all of those situations, he was on the phone to Taswater trying to find out what has happened. For the first one at the middle of the beach, we couldn't find anything, so there were no Taswater alerts, no sewer spills that they are aware of, nothing in the system, nothing in the stormwater pipes. So sometimes it just fails and sewer comes, you know, there's cross contamination. In the southern end, there has been some issues up on Wells Parade that Taswater have now dealt with. It's a known issue that occurs. There are blockages that occur. They come and unblock it and flush water through the system, so that may have accounted for the second failure. And in terms of the sewer spill today, you're correct. So there was a sewer spill reported to council today on Roslyn Avenue, and quite a long way from the beach, but still could have made its way to the beach. So Taswater came to that within half an hour of it being called in and dealt with it. So it was a spill, they think, of up to 5,000 litres that went into the system. So not the biggest spill, but a fairly sizable spill. And unfortunately, before Taswater had got there, had gone across the footpath and into a side entry pit on the road, so had entered the stormwater system. So Taswater flushed that out with thousands of litres of water. So it's possible that, well, it would have. That stormwater would have reached Blackmans Bay mid. as well. So Taswater again said it was a blockage caused by the things that we know cause blockages in the sewer system, wipes and all of those type things that we know, and so they cleared it, didn't need to do any other maintenance and left the site. So I think most of the failures that are occurring are related to sewer spills that Taswater does come to, but there's also often low-grade sewer spills that are happening, you know, potentially down at the back of people's backyards that they don't even know about, that eventually make their way into the groundwater and into our sewer system through cracks or whatever it might be. So a similar story to what happened in the south, potentially this hopefully will not get to where that went to. We didn't have a stormwater investigations officer at that time, so we didn't have someone who's out there every day looking into our system and noticing things straight away. So I think that that's made a really big difference for our ability to react.
Thank you very much for that great response and information. The next question is regarding abatement notices. So what department issues abatement notices at council, and what support do people get to understand them and act?
Mr. Smee can help us with that.
Through you, Mayor, depending on the nature of the issue, they're either issued by our compliance unit or they're issued through Environmental Health. It would depend on what the issue is. So is the question what support are staff given in terms of issuing the notice, or what support are the receivers of the notice given?
The receivers.
So generally the notices are reasonably straightforward in terms of the requirements to abate the hazard. So the notices themselves do provide a level of instruction in relation to what is required, but our staff are certainly more than happy to provide further support and information if that's required in terms of interpreting the requirements of the notice.
Thank you very much. And one further question, Mayor. We all have received an email and a follow-up regarding some questions around the Drew Point playground. Can we just have, I don't know, there was a social media, but I just thought for the record it would be good to know, updates about the Drew Point playground, that there was $450 in the budget for 2022, and then some extra to replace the Teen Ranger, which was removed in 2020. Excellent feedback about the Flying Fox and the Climbing Dome. Just people are kind of wondering, is there going to be any further community consultation, noting that the master plan was done, I think, in 2017?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, as we progress with the implementation of that plan, there would be further consultation on the various elements that we are going to be progressing with. But I mean, in terms of the work done to date and that's planned in the immediate future, that has been through a consultation phase. But yes, more generally, the implementation of the plan will be associated with more general communication and consultation.
Thank you. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I have two questions. The first is about the toilets at the Kingston Play Park near the exercise track. I believe it's the one that's halfway between the park and the actual exercise area. I received a few messages on the weekend saying that it was locked, and that one gentleman had two young kids and had an accident, as in soiled themselves and was a bit distressed that they couldn't get access to the park.
So those toilets have not been fully completed yet. They're just three quarters of the way through installation. And certainly when we were down there a week before last, they were still building them. So they might look complete from the outside.
Is it possible that they look complete from the outside and the person didn't know that?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, they are open. We had them opened in time for the day in the park. They shouldn't be locked. So whether there's some commissioning issues in terms of the locking mechanism I'd need to check.
Yeah, if you could check, because the character asked me to arrange for it to be open for him, mm-hmm. So since I don't have those keys on me. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The second question is about the upcoming move to the Tasmanian planning scheme. I'm aware, and this is, I think, more for the record than anything, there is a discussion behind the scenes about communicating to the residents of Kingborough about the move to the planning scheme. There's a lot of people concerned that we won't be contact them in a proper manner so that they can all receive notice. Are we able to share any preliminary high-level information to the public just to allay any fears about the direction we're heading on that?
So I think I've previously indicated that we will be endeavouring to send something out to all members of the community, alerting to them to the fact that there will be some public consultation. The timing of it is the issue. As we know, we are waiting on the TPC to get back to us to let us know when that consultation can start. We can't go to more consultation before that because we want to make sure that we're actually giving the correct information. But certainly we just have to keep a watching brief, but I've made a firm commitment that we would communicate. If it doesn't align with the dates of the insert into the rates brochure, which goes out in July, late June, early July, then obviously we need to work out in what other way we will do that. And it may be that we come back to council for a decision on how that occurs.
Right, okay. And the intention being if we're not able to communicate directly through the rates notice, we'll find some other direct method of communication.
Correct.
To those affected.
Correct.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Any further questions? Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of questions regarding back to Drew Point again. I've been contacted about people having dogs off-lead in a couple of areas, one on the foreshore and the other in the big grassy area where they had the awesome market on the weekend, ball throwing, that sort of activity. That is a no-dog area, is that correct, or not off-lead area?
I believe so, Mr. Smith. Yes.
Yep, okay. Is there signage up there saying as much?
Mr. Smee, can you recall if there's signage there?
Through you, mean not off the top of my head. I mean, it's a public place, so the default position is that dogs must be on a lead unless it's a declared exercise area, which it's not. So it any area that doesn't have a declaration and is a public place, the requirement is dog on a lead.
Okay.
And we're not required to sign that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the default position under the Act.
Understood. If members of the public had concerns about dogs off lead, what action should they take?
Look, certainly I'm aware that there is some discussion on social media at the moment around a particular individual who walks their dog on Blackmans Bay Beach, which is a dog prohibited area. So I know that that's an issue of concern. Likewise there, a simple phone call into our customer service team to alert them to where the activity is taking place, and I guess then the compliance team can look into the matter. And I think if we're particularly getting it in certain areas repeatedly, then obviously we do need to consider whether there's some sort of indication there to remind people that this is not an area where you're allowed to walk your dog either on the lead or off the lead in some cases.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, we will keep going. So we have one question on notice from councillors on page 6. It was in relation to proceeds of crime. It was asked by Councillor Cordova, and there was a response from Ms. Tyler Moore. The open session of council now adjourns at 6:03 p.m. and the planning authority commences at 6:03 p.m. So we're on page 8. DAS 2022 number 7, development application for subdivision creating 10 lots and one road lot at 37 Nebraska Road, Dens Point, with a recommendation on page 46. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Gladright. Second. Seconded, Councillor Bain. Can I just remind members before we go into the debate that we are, of course, now sitting as a planning authority, and the questions asked must be in accordance with the rules that apply when we sit as a planning authority. So please keep on track to those. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you, Mayor. So the proposal is for the creation of 10 lots and one road coming off Nebraska Road in Dens Point. I note that there were a large number of representations against the proposal, highlighting issues such as the unauthorised clearing of the land, landslide, stormwater, impacts on endangered species, and the list is quite a long list. I've read through the application thoroughly, and I feel confident that the concerns have been dealt with via the conditions of the permit. I note that there are a number of revised assessments that are being asked for, including a landslip assessment, bushfire hazard report, bushfire hazard management plan, and I was particularly pleased to see that there's a rehabilitation plan as well. I think we're all quite aware of the grave concerns that the community had around the illegal vegetation removal. Condition 5 provides instruction for the replacement of plantings, and there was a ratio of 3 trees planted for each tree removed. So I feel confident that the conditions of the permit address the concerns of the representors, and so I'm happy to support as recommended.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I've got a lot of questions, and I'll take us through the report and page numbers and things. The first one, in regards to page 13, noting the unlawful clearing that Councillor Gladright has mentioned, noting that this attracted a lot of media attention, it's not a planning authority matter, that one. But I guess I'm just wanting to understand how that might have occurred. What happened? Are we allowed to ask that as a planning authority, noting that it is in actual page 13? But I'm happy to skip that one if you feel.
Unfortunately, that is not relevant to the consideration that we are going through at the moment.
No worries. Only just asking that because it is on page 13, so I thought it was in the report. I could perhaps ask about it. Page 16... So it notes that the page 16 in the acceptable solutions area proposal says the proposed subdivision will impact on trees of high conservation value, and these impacts require assessment against performance criteria. There are 14 high very conservation value trees on the subject land. 4 of these trees are with disturbance, footprint of the proposed footway, electricity cable and easement. These trees are all mature eucalyptus white gums, very high conservation value, and provide habitat for 40 spotted pardalote. But then it notes on page 17, again sort of down the bottom there, says, therefore, to meet the requirements of this clause, so noting that these would be removed, so we're trying to mitigate the loss of these, the electricity infrastructure requires relocation to an alternative location for the easement and things like that, and therefore then a condition is recommended for inclusion in any permit issued, required an amendment plan. So basically, we are trying our best to protect these trees, and we are asking for an amended plan, is that correct, to ensure that the electricity infrastructure doesn't impact on these trees. So I guess, and I will be asking this a bit, why didn't we ask the applicant to amend these plans prior to coming to council?
Ms. Dennexter, could you assist us with that?
Certainly through you, Mayor. So we did request further information on the impacts on the trees from the electricity infrastructure and the footway as part of the further information request. Just to clarify, the trees weren't identified as needing to be removed for the electricity infrastructure, so we did receive an arborist assessment that said that it would be feasible to install that electricity infrastructure and retain the trees. But then in the process of doing our detailed assessment and further discussions with TAS Networks, it was determined that that could actually be moved, the easement could be moved entirely to avoid the impact altogether and also avoid future conflict between the electricity infrastructure and the trees going forward. So, yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Thank
Great.
You. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. So I guess I interpreted it, there could be future impact and there would be a lot of, I guess, things that would need to do to mitigate the loss of those trees. So it's great that it can be moved. But, yep, that was just a concern that it didn't come to us with a final completion, that it was in the report, that it actually would be in a different location. Page 20... Sorry, I'm just moving my page. So page 20, if you can just explain to me what this means. This was a lot to get our head around, members of the public, when reading these planning authority matters. So it says under clause 12.5.1, the building areas and future development of the lots are required to avoid and minimise impacts on environmental values, including the building areas and associated hazard management areas being located to minimise impacts as far as reasonably practical. Can you just explain that to me in, I guess, some practical terms, please?
Ms. Dan Exter.
Through you, Mayor. I'll try. So the scheme requires us to look not just at the impact of the subdivision, but also what's likely to occur on the lots going forward, so where the buildings are going to go, as well as the bushfire hazard management. And it's saying that those things should be located, so in the first instance, the building area and then the hazard management area that relates to that building area need to be located in a manner that minimise the impacts to the extent that they can. So it's not always feasible to avoid impacts altogether, but they can be smaller building areas, they can be moved in their location, and also the hazard management area can change in size depending on the future construction standard of any building, habitable building.
Thank you.
Councillor Midgley.
Also on page 20, I can see that we outline the replacement plantings due to the illegal moving of the high conservation trees. And there's a Part 5 agreement to ensure that there's checking in place, the planting requirements are adhered to, and the statement of the loss of the very high conservation trees, value trees, requires offsetting, and the replacement planting should achieve a ratio of 3 trees planted for each tree removed. Just looking at my notes. Councillors in the previous council, we had a clause in some of our planning permits that noted that trees had to be looked after for the landscaping, I guess, looked after for the lifetime of the tree. Would it be applicable in this instance to perhaps look at that clause and re-enter something like that? Just to ensure that there was a big loss of trees, to ensure that that the trees that are then replaced are maintained.
Ms. Dan Exter.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, certainly, and that's captured through... it's intended to be captured through the Part 5 agreement that would not just provide for the plantings and the maintenance of those plantings in the short term, but also require their retention into the future. Yeah.
So that's strong enough to ensure that these replacement plantings are looked after?
In my opinion, yes, but... yes.
Through you, Mayor, I did have a discussion with Councillor Midgley earlier about this. It was the question about the standing condition that we used to have. If landscaping was to be installed, it must be maintained for all of time, that dead and diseased plants to be replaced. That was a condition that would be applied to unit developments or commercial developments where you wouldn't usually have a Part 5 agreement asking for rehabilitation. It is something that could be added on if the councillors would like to add it on. My comment would be that once the people purchase the properties, they're not reading this planning permit, because this planning permit really is for the developer, because they're having to do all the works and the obligations with it. The Part 5 agreements are registered on title, so they're discoverable to the purchasers. So then that's where they know to go and look at it, and in this particular instance, there's several Part... Well, they'll all be put in one Part 5 agreement eventually, not separate ones, but they will see those maintenance requirements in there, so it's probably actually stronger than the condition that sits on a permit.
Thank you. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. The next one question is regarding pages 28, 29, the land slip issues identified. And I guess the comments here were of concern to me, big concern. The recent clearing of the land has potential to exacerbate the risk of further landscape in the area. In considering the landslip report lodged with the application, they advise that the report has not recognised the existing landslide in proposal lot 7. Further, the location and failure mechanism of that feature is not considered in the on-site wastewater report for either the proposed dwelling or existing properties downhill. Minerals Resources Tasmania have recommended to Council that further geotechnical investigation be undertaken, and these follow the recommendations of then so forth and so on. I understand Councillor Glade-Wright has said that that will be as part of the conditions, but for me, I would have loved, you know, it would have been great as a, sitting as a planning authority to actually see a current landslip report as recommended here be put forward to us tonight at Council. And so therefore I do have quite a concern in supporting this one tonight, as we don't have a current report. Even though I do note it is a condition, I still see that as a risk, and it seems to be, if we're getting advice from Mineral Resources Tasmania that they recommend that we need an updated report, it would have been great to have had this tonight so that we could have actually had all the information to look at.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the matters of the landslip and the errors in that report really became apparent during the representation period, and we thank the public for their contributions, obviously, in representations, because it's not just a token effort. We do, there are discoverable things out of that, and in this instance we did. The letter for MRT Mineral Resources Tasmania came to us following the representation period. It was actually made outside their representation period, but of course we still acknowledge the content in that. It's my understanding that that was raised with them directly by members of the public, and it was discovered. So during the planning process, we usually ask for further information in the, after the, at the initial assessment stage, so we can ask for those reports. Once we became aware of that, we did raise that with the applicant. Once it's a difficult thing, once we do an assessment, we do the representations, it's not till you get to the final assessment point that you've got all the external referrals have come in, or the internal referrals come in, or the representations have come in, that we get those really down to the detail when we're doing the assessment against each and every clause of the planning scheme that's relevant to an application. So it was much later in the process. We did ask the applicant to provide an extension of time so that we could resolve those matters and some of the other matters that are addressed in the conditions, but the applicant declined to extend that time, so we have a statutory time frame we have to meet. We need to still come to the chamber because of the number of representations, so it remains slightly unresolved. The applicant was made aware of the conditions, the main conditions we were applying to the permit, and they're aware of that risk. So the applicant is carrying a risk that when they do the landslide report, that something's going to become apparent that may change the layout or what occurs on that site. We believe that any changes that come from that or other reports will mostly be contained within the site and shouldn't necessarily have a further material detriment on people outside the site. It might affect them. I mean, a scenario could be, and I'm not saying this is the case, but just to give you an idea, a scenario might be that they can't have 10 lots. They need to reduce the number of lots because they can't accommodate everything that needs to be accommodated in each of the lots or in the infrastructure that's being built there. So that's a risk that the applicant has chosen to take on by not going into those conversations with us before the decision was made. And certainly if people are not happy, whether it's the applicant's not happy with the decision or the residents aren't happy with the decision, there are appeal rights available to them. But certainly it's our intention to get the best outcome we can through those reports, and risk is the biggest thing we have to do with landslip. We certainly aren't going to allow risk to persons or property, whether they're the persons or property on the subject site or on the neighbouring properties, so that's very important. The MRT, we did speak with MRT about their letter. They didn't necessarily flag it as it was an absolute stop, go, don't, you must refuse the application. Not that they have technically have the authority to do that, but certainly they would indicate as an agency to another agency. They were concerned with the methodology of that report. We've reviewed our internal systems about that. We don't have geologists on site, on staff that we do that, so we're meeting with MRT going forward about resolving and looking at some of those landslide reports. There's very few engineers within TASI that actually provide those reports, and we are keen to try and avoid this occurring again.
Thank you very much.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd just some further comments on that. Yeah, there has been an extensive number of representations, and as Councillor Glaidwright says, they range from wildlife, vegetation clearing, landslip, bushfire management plan, which I note also needs an update in condition, stormwater, which I also note that Lot 100 needs an upgraded design of the stormwater plan, the lack of public open space, sewerage, traffic concerns, social amenities and building concerns. So I just thank the representatives for making that time and looking at this place they get to call home as a living there or a shack in what is important to them. So I'll be open-minded, councillors, and I look forward to the debate and hearing others sharing.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. A few questions. The first one's about the Part 5 agreement, and it refers to, I'm looking at page 24, the Part 5 agreement on the current title exempts the land from open space contributions. I'm just looking for a bit of history of the origins of that particular aspect of the Part 5 agreement. Why are they exempt from public open space?
Ms. Dennexter.
Through you, Mayor. I'll do my best to answer this. This wasn't something I was directly involved with assessing, but my understanding is that I may get this wrong, so I don't know if it's better that I try to answer. No.
Sorry, General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. My understanding, Councillor Cordova, is that the previous owner of the site, the Barrow family, undertook a subdivision around the 2016 mark, thereabouts, from memory, and as part of that subdivision, public open space was provided to this council, but also there was land along the beach frontage that was provided to council. And as a result of that and that council decision on that subdivision at the time, there was a requirement made that there would be no further ability for council to acquire public open space on the remaining land.
Thank you. That's helpful. Through you, Mayor. Next question is about the... So the background is the unapproved works involving the removal of vegetation and or trees and associated works on the property took place between the 14th of June in 2022 and the 22nd of June in 2022. The Arboricultural Impact Assessment Tasmanian Arboricultural Consultants report is dated the 30th of June 2022. My question is, was the entirety of that report prepared after the unapproved works were completed, including any site inspections or visits?
Yep, I don't know if we're veering away from whether this is relevant to the application. Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I will ask Mr. Dennexter to ask the specifics about it, I guess just about the relevance on the application. The actual enforcement and the actions of enforcement are probably a separate matter, but it is reasonable to have some recognition of the vegetation that was removed because they did retrospectively apply for parts of that through the permit, and some of the conditions are tied to what occurred in that. So on that basis, I think Mr. Dennexter can answer more of the detail.
Thank you, Ms. Dennexter.
Through you, Mayor. I can't actually answer the direct question as to when the arborist assessment was undertaken and whether that, you know, whether they did any site visits before the clearing or after the clearing without looking through the detail. But what I can confirm is that the trees that they were assessing weren't on a part of the site that related to the unauthorised clearing. So there was no relationship between what they needed to assess and any works that occurred without approval.
Thank you. So, through you, Mayor, if I'm understanding correctly, the arborist's report doesn't actually speak to any of the trees that were removed, nor does it have any impact on whether they were there before or whether they were there after. The arboriculturalist report has actually no view, no visibility over that aspect of this proposal.
Ms. Dennexter.
Through you, Mayor. That is correct. The arborist report was specifically to look at the impacts of the proposed electricity infrastructure on the trees and didn't relate at all to the tree plan. The tree plan was prepared by a different consultant, which was ERA.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
And so I think I have the date of the ERA report. I thought the ERA report was December of 2019 or something like that, wasn't it? What was the date of the ERA report? I thought the ERA report was... the bushfire management plan. Yeah, it was the 17th of December 2021. So that's before any of those trees were affected as well, isn't it?
Mr. Nexter, through you, Mayor. Sorry to clarify, there's an ERA planning report, there's an ERA bushfire report, but there was also a tree plan that was prepared and went on to the subdivision plans that was informed by ERA, but it was updated following the unauthorised tree removal. So that tree plan was out on further information at the time of the clearing, so we were still trying to ascertain the number of trees on the site, how they related to the development. And the unauthorised clearing did complicate that a little bit, so there were some further edits to that plan, which I understand were undertaken by the applicant and their surveyor, utilising information that actually arose through the investigation for the unauthorised clearing in terms of identifying some additional trees that were still there and some trees that had been removed.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. So I'm getting a sense that... My question was going to be, how can we be sure of the validity of the report, considering the substantial changes that took place on the land? But what I'm hearing is that the report was indeed updated to take into account the changes made on the land.
Mr. Nexter. Through you, Mayor. Yes, that is correct.
Thanks. So my next question is, on page 19 of the report, it says, quote, while limited details were provided on the future services and utilities... While limited details were provided on where future services and utilities would be located, the proposed building areas for the lots are predominantly located to enable retention of remaining native trees.
Could you just let us know what page you're on of the report?
Page 19.
Thank you.
So my question is regarding this. What are those limited details that have actually been provided about where future services and utilities will be located? What limited details do we have, and on what basis do we trust that the proponent would actually comply with their commitment to locate services and utilities to enable tree retention?
Mr. Nexter. Through you, Mayor. So the limited details are quite normal. So it's not a limitation of the information submitted with the application. It's the limitation of what you can provide at a subdivision stage in terms of how people are going to develop the land and where exactly things are going to be located. So they've got identified future building areas and then obviously services such as the actual internal power installation, on-site wastewater, things like that also need to be taken into account. So we don't get to that level of detail at this stage of an application, and it's the Part 5 agreement that is proposed to ensure that when the development of those lots occurs, it will happen in a manner that works around those trees. So that's the intention of the Part 5, and that's what will ensure future owners are held to account in terms of that tree retention.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor.
Yep, Councillor Cordova.
Question now about page 22. This is about the site frontages. The report reads, lots 1 to 9 do not comply with frontage to the new road lot. And my question is just, please unpack for us how it is that the proposal meets 12.5.2 performance criteria P1D, which says that there should be an acceptable level of access, safety, convenience and legibility. Please explain how it does comply with the performance criteria.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor. Our development engineers do the assessments against these clauses, but I am familiar with them. I'm not proposing to be a development engineer. But it's met the performance criteria of letter D, by still being suitable enough for the cars to make passage. It's convenient. They're not sort of just squashing in between the fences if there were fences built between each of those. So there is some ability to make it smaller, obviously, because that's the performance criteria. Allows the legibility is fine as well because it's coming off a court bowl, with the exception of a couple of the lots that aren't at the court bowl. So it's clearly legible. It's very typical for a court bowl layout, and is not going to cause any traffic conflicts unless, of course, they were all happen to be driving out of the driveway at one time, but normal courtesy and road user behaviour would occur in that instance. So the development engineers haven't raised any concerns about that.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. I can imagine one scenario in which they would all be trying to get out at one time, and that is in the event of an emergency. So my question is, how does it comply with performance criteria 1J, P1J, which reads multiple escape routes are provided if in a bushfire prone area.
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, there are many, many properties and estates that don't have multiple accesses. It's something that's acknowledged. We don't have multiple accesses from many of them. Yes, that's come up as a concern within our municipality and many others throughout the country because we're bushfire prone. I don't have a great answer for Jay, but obviously they find that the risk is acceptable. It probably is partly as well the new road that's created is not a long road, it's a very short road in the scheme of roads, unlike if it was going up into the hinterland of back and beyond of Kingborough, where it's very long and quite dangerous, but it's relatively short and lower risk.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. Page 32. This is in relation to the Biodiversity Code. The report says, quote, with the current subdivision bushfire hazard report and accompanying bushfire management plan submitted with the application ERA, this is the ERA report, 17th of December 2021, my question, which let me think about whether it's been answered or not, given the vegetation on the site has changed considerably since 2021, on what basis is the bushfire hazard report and accompanying bushfire management plan considered at all valid if they are no longer up to date and don't reflect a real-life context of the site? I note the previous answer, so I'll just advance my question by saying, is it standard procedure to grant approval for something and then attach conditions to it later? Wouldn't it be more prudent to wait to grant approval or refusal until after a valid and up-to-date bushfire management plan was produced?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, this is similar to the landscape question that we have. We asked for a revised report. Ideally, we would love to have all these things resolved before a permit is issued. The developer is carrying the risk that they may not develop, they'd be able to develop their property even if they have a valid permit, if they can't satisfy the requirements. It's also important to understand, I know you didn't ask this question specifically, but each application that comes in for each of the dwellings will be required to get their assessment done for their design of their house as well.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordover.
Through you, Mayor. Next question is now about...
Sorry, Ms. Dennexter had something she wanted to add to that.
Please.
Yeah, if I may, through you, Mayor, just further to that, I think it is probably worth just touching on the first part of your question in terms of whether the bushfire assessment was done for before or after the clearing and whether that has a bearing on the revised report. The bushfire report, as it currently is proposing the entire site to be managed as low-threat vegetation, which is quite consistent to the unauthorised works that have occurred. So it's not because of those works, but it reached an outcome that is not dissimilar. And whether that vegetation was standing at the time of the assessment, I don't think has a bearing on the outcome that they've proposed in that sense, if that makes sense. So they looked at the site and there is a hazard there and it needs to be managed, but their solution was to manage that land and in its entirety. And so that the clearing that's occurred wouldn't change that assessment. In terms of the condition that's been put on, that was put on with an understanding of the Bushfire Prone Areas Code and how the Australian Standard works and what the distances are that are required to achieve the requirements of that code, which is as a minimum construction to BAL 19, and try to balance that with protecting the area of biodiversity that is still there and is in the biodiversity protection area. So that area was largely unaffected by the clearing. It was subject to an abatement notice, but that can regenerate. There's a solution with the bushfire that requires a revision, but it's quite a feasible outcome. It's a similar scenario to the landslide where it would be ideal to have it now, but it's not, it's how it's, there's a way of achieving it. It's not a question mark as to whether it can be achieved. There's capacity. It's currently designed to BAL 12.5. It can be designed to BAL 19, basically, is the expectation of that condition.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Through you, Mayor. Next question is now actually about landslip. So 28, page 28, the report says the application is supported by a landslide assessment report from Geo Environmental Solutions, March 2022. However, as we have discussed on page 13, the report acknowledges that the unapproved works involving the removal of vegetation and or trees and associated works took place between the 14th of June and the 22nd of June. And it is my understanding that most experts would agree that tree roots reinforce soil layers, they anchor the soil to bedrock and form buttresses against soil movement. Trees also reduce landslide risk by lowering soil moisture, interception, evaporation and transpiration are the primary mechanisms. So my question is, if the landslide assessment report was conducted and produced in March, but then the unimproved works took place on a large scale, clearing mature vegetation in June, on what basis was that report considered valid and relevant, and why didn't everything go back to the drawing board after June to get new, relevant, accurate reports, as essentially was the implication of the submission from Mineral Resource Tasmania?
Ms. Dan Exter. Through you, Mayor. We did actually request and receive a revised landslide report following the unauthorised clearing. It was something that we requested was updated in response. I don't have a copy of the report in front of me, but I can only think that the date on the front was the original report date, but there's a revision date within the report. And if inside the report itself, and I think this might be included in... Anyway, inside the landslide report, it has actually got figures in there that reflect the level of soil disturbance and vegetation removal that occurred through the unauthorised works, and it did make recommendations in relation to that. So the landslide report did address the clearing, but subsequently, through the representation process, what it didn't do was address the historic landslide event that had occurred on the site, and... Based on MRT's submission, it also wasn't in accordance with the Australian Geomechanics Society guidelines fully. So it was updated, though, in response to the works that had occurred.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Nearing the end of my questions, what is the Planning Authority's liability or exposure regarding verifying the timeliness and accuracy of these expert reports that are submitted in support of development applications? So, for example, if a planning authority were to approve a hypothetical piece of land that was being held together by tree roots and a landslip report was conducted with those trees in situ, but then all of a sudden all the trees were removed and the old landslip report was then submitted in place of the new landslip report that we were waiting on. If there was to be a landslip at that site that caused significant damage and harm, would council or us as a planning authority be exposed to any litigation, reputational damage or claims of negligence or dereliction of duty?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I am not a lawyer, as we're aware. My understanding is that it is tied up with the application form, so when the applicant puts the application form in, they are doing a statutory declaration that declares that all the information is true and correct to the best of their knowledge at the time of the decision. The liability lies with the consultants who make the recommendations that we base it on. So the planning scheme is written that it's prepared by a suitably qualified person, and we do our best to ensure that they are a suitably qualified person, and we do push back from time to time that they're not, much to the frustration of some applicants who feel that it will do, so we do push back, and the liability lies with them. If an applicant were to go and modify a site in a way that meant that the reports were not true and correct, then there would have to be questions about their liability with respect to that and maintaining that all the information in their application is true and correct.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Through you, Mayor. We've heard now, with respect to the bushfire plan, that ideally we would want these things to be resolved before a determination was made whether or not to approve it tonight. We've also heard, in respect to the landslip, that the applicant has declined to extend that timeframe, and therefore the applicant is carrying that risk, so to speak, that the landslip will turn out to be significant for their application. So on those two fronts, my question here is just that if we've heard that it would really be the the consultants who would be liable, it wouldn't be the planning authority, and it would be the applicant who is carrying some risk. My question is, on what basis should we, press ahead with so many unknowns? And is it standard practice on a subdivision application to press ahead despite there being so many clear unknowns and so many areas in which ideally we would have more information before us?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I just want to make it clear that I'm I don't have the background, the legal background of liability, so my comments were just general comments and going to be accountable for ensuring that we don't have any liability risk on that. That's a legal matter and the planning authority. It is a preference that it was resolved. We have talked with the applicant. We believe from the information that we have from those reports that it should be, it's reasonably likely that they are resolvable issues. If we believe that there was no way of achieving it at all, then quite possibly we wouldn't go down this pathway. It wouldn't be fair on the client or the applicant in that instance, so we wouldn't do that. But from our discussions with the various consultants, with the in-house knowledge, we believe that there will be an ability, but that doesn't mean it won't come with modifications to the design, and the applicant's been made aware of that and they carry that risk. So it's not ideal. We get stuck in the situation, as I said before, we do our best for the assessments, but until you get down to the very fine detail at the end of the assessment, once you've got internal referrals, external referrals and the representations, you can't forecast everything's going to occur, and it's unfortunate that the planning system is set up in a way where you couldn't go and ask for further information and stop the clock. If we don't make a decision within the clock, then the applicant can lodge an appeal with the tribunal for not making a decision within time. It's in the interest of the applicant, obviously, that councillors don't just drag it on for all eternity. That wouldn't be fair, so that's how the system is done. And we will continue to work with the applicant to get the right outcome, keeping in mind the concerns of the representors and the concerns that they have. And if we felt that the outcomes of the recommendations or the amended reports was going to cause further material detriment to those neighbouring residents or the representors who may not be neighbouring, then we would unlikely proceed in this manner. But we think that it's a reasonable approach in this instance.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor, I will race through my substantive contribution here that this is a proposal that has attracted significant community interest, and the discretions that you can read about on page 8, they are what ultimately this planning authority will be judging this proposal on, specifically for the low-density residential area zone, the low-density residential zone area A. I will be talking specifically now about how this proposal fails to comply with the acceptable solutions and demonstrates an inability to meet the relevant performance criteria, and I foreshadow moving an alternate motion to refuse this application should the motion fail. So my reasons are the following. Clause 12.4.1, non-dwelling development A1D, which refers to clause 12.4.2A4. This is to the question of whether impacts on very high conservation value trees are unavoidable. I think they were avoidable. So this proposal failed due to the acknowledged ongoing impact on high conservation value trees, and you can read about that on pages 16 and 17. Next is clause 12.5.1 lot design A2 and A3. As the report says on page 18, environmental values will be adversely affected. The proposal fails to meet the performance criteria due to lots 5 and 7 being 11.72 metres and 10.89 metres respectively, even though the minimum is 6 metres, I acknowledge that, and the acceptable solution is 30 metres, I acknowledge that. In my opinion, lots 5 and 7 do not provide opportunity for reasonable vehicular and pedestrian access. Next is clause 12.5.2, roads A1. It failed due to performance criteria 1, D, H, and, as we noted in the questions there, J, particularly around that multiple areas of egress, the multiple exits that are required, so it fails that performance criteria. Clause 29.4.3, design A1, this proposal fails to meet performance criteria 1AII, 1A2 because, quote, the extent of clearing is the minimum necessary to provide for buildings associated works and associated bushfire protection measures, end quote, and as the report acknowledges on page 26, that, quote, the proposal is unable to comply with A1A, end quote, and therefore it falls on us as a planning authority to determine the discretion associated with performance criteria P1, and I have determined that it does not satisfy that criteria P1. Then to the issue of landslip, I note the explanations on page 28 and our discussions just now. However, I do expect that we would need to see an updated landslip report having been conducted subsequent to land clearing taking place so that we can read some actual analysis of that landslip risk. As the MRT, the Mineral Resources Tasmania submission said, the recent clearing of the subject land has the potential to exacerbate the risk of further landslip development in this area, end quote. And so it's seriously worth considering that and the landslip on Lot 7 before we proceed. And then to E10 Biodiversity Code, the proposal fails to meet performance criteria of the Biodiversity Code at clause E10.8.1, P1, B and C, specifically B1 and C1, quote, subdivision works are designed and located to minimise impacts, end quote, which in my opinion they are not located to minimise impacts. Finally, I want to make the point that the interim planning scheme, the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015, is crystal clear at 8.10.1b when it talks about, in determining an application for any permit, the planning authority must, in addition to the matters required by SS 51.2 of the Act, take into consideration A, all applicable standards and requirements in this planning scheme, and B, any representations received pursuant to and in conformity with SS 57.5 of the Act, but in the case of the exercise of discretion, only insofar as each such matter is relevant to the particular discretion being exercised. This application received 107 representations, 103 of which were against, and 4 representations were in support. And where those submissions are pursuant to and in conformity with SS 57.5 of the Act, councillors sitting as a planning authority must consider them. So to those people who made a representation, whether it was for or against, I thank them and I say your representation does matter and it is considered by a planning authority where that planning authority is doing its job in accordance with its responsibilities. There are so many unknowns around this proposal that we have heard about today from our experts. I think there is a significant question around some of the information that we're using in order to make our determinations on this, but what is crystal clear is that there are many performance criteria where this proposal does not comply. For the reasons outlined before, I will be voting against this proposal and I urge others to do the same.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Next, I have Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I intend to keep my comments brief because I think many of the issues that need to be canvassed with respect to this report have already been canvassed. And I also appreciate the mountain of work that our planning staff have done in putting this report together. Can I recognise at the outset that I am going to make myself a very unpopular person with the representatives for this application? And I apologise for that because I have a lot of sympathy for the representations that have been made, a lot of sympathy. The issue that we have, and that I see we have as a planning authority, is that for the most part, the issues that have been raised in those representations do not have a great deal to do with the application that is before us, and we don't have the ability to take into account some of those matters that have already been canvassed by my colleagues. And that's not to suggest that I endorse in any way the actions of this applicant. I do not. I denounce them completely and wholeheartedly. But we are left in a situation where we need to assess an application for development on this site. Like I said, our staff have done a mountain of work in producing this report, and I'm sure that it's a task that gave them no pleasure either. But the reality is that this application is one that meets the requirements of the planning scheme. Rightly or wrongly, that is the case here. And like I say, I take no pleasure in voting for the recommended motion, but I do not see that as a member of the Planning Authority I have any option but to do so on this occasion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Further contributions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question regarding a possible misunderstanding on my part as to numbers of trees damaged, and I think there might be a typo in the report. It's around page 48 and then page 73. On page 48 at Roman numerals 3, I'll just let people get there who are flipping through their books. It provides replacement for plantings for the loss of 4 native trees. And then on page 73, about halfway down, it talks about 5 trees have been removed without authorisation. So I'm just trying to understand the difference between, is it 4 or 5? Is it a typo? Have I got it wrong? Am I looking at the wrong thing?
What's the second page you're referencing?
Yes, page 73, about halfway down the page. Someone's shaking their head. You don't see that? Oh. It's under the dot point. It's the halfway down in the compliance comments, under the third dot point, where it says, of these native trees, 5 have already been removed without authorisation, et cetera, et cetera. So is it 4 trees that are in question here? Is it 5 trees? Because it affects, from my point of view, the replacement ratio and also any particular fines that are calculated.
Thank you. Ms. Denexter?
Through you, Mayor. I can see we're moving between a checklist in the appendices and the report proper. So one is likely to be more up to date than the other. Bear with me while I double check the plans. It has no bearing on any fines issued.
Right.
If I just bring
it may have an issue on the replacement ratios, it would affect.
Possibly, but it may also be, let me just double check the Alocasia Arena, it may be that tree was below the threshold for a tree, if you like. So some of the trees shown on here were less than 25 centimetres. So bear with me.
That's okay.
But so here it is. Tree 89 was an Alocasia Arena verticillata, which was less than 25 centimetres and had been removed. So it was below the threshold for a tree. So it's correct to say that 4 trees within the meaning under the scheme were removed. It's also fair to say that Alocasia Arenas will be part of the rehabilitation plan anyway without requiring the replacement planting. So I think the conditions are capture that adequately.
So in your opinion, the number of 4 is the correct number to go by?
Correct.
Yeah, which means the replacement ratio is accurate and correct. And I would like to sort of echo Councillor Street's comments. Den's Point is an area that I'm quite close to. I know half the people that live there. Some of them are personal friends, and I understand the upset and the uproar. And it behooves Council to only make a decision based on the rules of the planning scheme. I'd like to also repeat what Councillor Street said about honouring the planning team. This report was enormous. It was incredibly thorough. And I would like to compliment the writer of the report and the authoriser for the amount of effort they put into it, because I felt you took into account all the representations, positive and negative, and you detailed very forensically that you took into account the representations, the concerns, and I agree with what Councillor Street said, that some of the representations weren't relevant per se to the actual development, but you took into account the feelings and the tones of the community. You've admitted that actually some discoveries came from those representations, and I would like to honour you for that, because sometimes people, when they write and feel like council does whatever council wants to do and I don't have a voice, and it's just not true all the time. I don't believe that to be the case, especially here. And I believe that the 30 recommendations, which is enormous and all-encompassing, which the applicant has actually written to council and said that they accept those recommendations, is adequate for me to also support approval of this as per the recommendation from council staff.
Thank you, Councillor Antali. Are there further contributions? Councillor Fox.
I think tonight's debate has been extremely useful, and I find it, I'm being torn, but I am going to support the recommendation because I do feel as a planning authority we don't have the room to move on this. I am disappointed that we don't have the reports that are referred to before us, and I feel that maybe, I have been reassured by the staff that those outcomes can be achieved, and that is the main reason that I'm not going to go against this recommendation. But I must say I am deeply upset by the amount of disturbance that this, and that's not a pun, that this development application has caused. The community is very small in Dens Point, and obviously I'd say that the majority of the people are very, very upset and hurt by this situation. And I'm also very impressed, though, the way that the staff have dealt with the situation very professionally. And everybody's done their best to try and reach a positive outcome. I'm sad that three trees to replace mature trees, which may well be hundreds of years old, is an outcome of the loss of those trees in an area where there are 40 spotted pardalotes, which are on the brink of extinction. That is really the most tragic part of this whole development. And yet, at the end of the day, as a planning authority, all these conditions have been put in place, all the mitigation is supposed to be happening. It's a very difficult one, and the hazard that the landslip has occurred in this area. There's obviously podzolic soil. Even the road itself in the past almost slipped into the sea, and council had to spend a lot of money to shore it up and stop it happening. It's a very mobile area, and the local residents around this area are going to be affected, whether there are mitigation measures or not. The fact that they are going to be worried about it, that they're below this subdivision in many cases, they will be concerned, and there's nothing they can do about it. And I'm really sad that they have to appeal the decision if we decide tonight to approve it. It should not be up to them to be in the position where they are appealing it. It would be much better if council could ask the developer to defer the matter until the reports come in. To me, that would have been a much better outcome, and I'm disappointed that the applicants didn't accept that situation. However, they have taken on the liability, and I guess that's the position we're in, and there's not much we can do about it. And as Councillor Antoli said, this was a mammoth report. It was extremely difficult to read, but I have read it, and it's very conclusive, very well put together. But unfortunately, I don't think we have the room to move to refuse it. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Firstly, just a question touching on something that's already been raised. With several of the conditions being revised plans and reports that will be subject to council staff approval, I'm wondering, do these reports become publicly available following any decision to provide members of the public a level of assurance?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, once they are endorsed, they can be viewed, but they can't be copied under the copyright law. We do have a policy on that as well, so that yes, they can be viewed.
Thank you. As has already been stated, I'm also disappointed that these reports aren't available now, but I think the planners have cleared up why that's the case. I'd like to acknowledge all the representations. It's very unusual, I think, to get this many, and as the council staff have stated, Some of the feedback has led to further investigation, so it's certainly been put to good use. I think the report that we've got in front of us is very, very comprehensive, and I'm glad to see that so many conditions have been put on this so that we can try and rectify some of the damage that's been done and get it back to a reasonable state. And I think on that basis, I'll be supporting the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Dean.
Look, I'm glad that Councillor Antoli and Councillor Street have acknowledged the work of the staff that's gone into this. And like Councillor Bain, I thank all the representatives that for their submissions, because honestly, it's due to them that I guess we've got consultation now through Mineral Resources Tasmania, and that there will be a further report into that issue, which is for me the real sticking point and the major issue, as we've already discussed tonight. I agree with the other councillors' concerns. It would be nice to have the information for us in terms of those reports, but as we've heard, it's found that the areas, if it is found that the area is too risky due to landslip issues, then there will need to be amendments, and note that the applicant is carrying significant risk in that area. I feel similarly to those councillors who expressed the disappointment about what's gone in terms of the land clearing, which is noted on page 13. But ultimately, I am confident in the planning team's work and the conditions attached, and note that the applicant is obviously, like I've said, carrying significant risk here. So if it is passed, I just want to point out that I guess there still is a lot of work to be done here, a lot of reports and a lot of safeguards that put in place, I suppose, for the subdivision, if recommended and passed, ultimately goes ahead.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Are there any further contributions? Before I ask Councillor Gladewright to sum up, just for my contribution, I don't want to delay us any longer, but I did want to also just acknowledge the work of Council staff in relation to this, and also to note the number of representations that we did receive from members of the community in relation to this. I know certainly I received emails from individuals not just on Bruny Island or within Tasmania, but even some from interstate in relation to this. There was some interest in the matter. I know that for those representors that there is probably the feeling that if we pass this tonight, that we're not doing our job as a council, but to them I need to say, we have to rely on the expert advice that is provided to us from our qualified planning staff. None of us who sit around this table hold planning qualifications. And so we rely on the advice. We also have to rely on the planning scheme that is the law that we have to comply with. And so when we sit here as a planning authority, we sit under different circumstances than when the open session of council sits. When the open session of council sits and we discuss issues, we're allowed to bring the feelings of the community to the table. When we're sitting as a planning scheme, we're not able to do that. And that's something that is really difficult for the community to understand and to accept. And it's not something that sits comfortably with us as councillors. It puts us in a very difficult position. That's the law and the regulations under which we do operate. So I know for people who are observing this, the planning scheme can seem very, very complex, and that's because it is. And the situation we act under is also. So I won't go over any of the other points that others have made, just to say I think that Councillor Street and Councillor Antoli summed up the situation very well. I believe that what we have before us, as assessed by our qualified staff, does meet the requirements of the planning scheme. And as councillors, it is incumbent upon us to consider that advice and consider that if we act against that advice, that we could end up in a situation where we end up going against that advice, it's appealed and it goes to the tribunal, then it is the ratepayers ultimately who pay then for the cost of us defending that. And that is something that is always in the back of our minds, and so I believe we do have to rely on that advice. So I will be supporting this as well, and I'll hand over to Councillor Gladewright if she would like to sum up. No? Okay, no sum up. Okay, I'm going to put the motion. It's as printed on page... just go back to that now. It's been a while since I was there. Page 46 of the agenda. It was moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Against.
A division is required. A show of hands. All those in favour? Is Councillors Antoli, Fox, Dean, Bain, Richardson, Street, Gladewright and Reet? Those against? Is Councillors Cordova and Midgley? The motion is carried. We now turn to page 83, DA 2022-480, development application for mixed-use commercial building, offices, retail and cafe and associated roadworks, footpath and stairs at Kingston Park 7 Goshawk Way, Kingston and Goshawk Way Road Reserve, with a recommendation on page 104. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder for this one, please. Anybody? Councillor sure. Gladewright, seconded Councillor Cordova. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you, Mayor. So this proposal is for a mixed-use commercial building and associated roadworks. I note that there were six representations. The general sentiment expressed in the representations, if I've got this correct, was that the height is too excessive. But actually the specific area plan for this area permits a maximum height of 20 metres and this proposal is for 18.2, so it's well below the maximum height limit. Do we have any information about an anchor tenant or is that not relevant?
It's not relevant.
Not really relevant, okay. Well, I'm happy to support this motion. I feel like... it has all the representations have been adequately addressed and it meets the planning scheme, so I'm happy to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I have some questions around this one, but I'll just preface those questions by saying that this is a particular development that has been the subject of some consternation at the initial phases, and obviously the Council pushed it back. And so I shouldn't have used that term, pushed it back. What I mean to
Sorry,
say
Councillor
is that...
Councillor Cordova, you're actually incorrect. We haven't considered...
No, that's why I'm just saying I've withdrawn that. I misspoke. But what I'm saying is that we have had a lot of discussion around it. There's been council workshops and things to that effect.
We had one workshop.
There's been one workshop. So
on this proposal.
Yes, and I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that there's been a lot of consideration around the look, the height limits, the what's included and what's not included. And so the questions that I have, I just wanted to point out that, as it says on page 92, the supporting design analysis prepared by Nettleton Tribe provides that the building will be designed to have a reduced overall operational energy consumption below that of a comparable standard practice building. This will be achieved through the use of solar panels, facades designed to minimise heat loads, vertical shading devices exceeding insulation and glazing specifications for ESD, reduced reliance on heating and air conditioning, motion sensor lighting to appropriate common areas, the use of large internal concrete structures such as stairwells or lift shafts, which provide a large volume of thermal mass to reduce cooling and heating requirements. So I just wanted a bit more information, if it's available, about the extent to which this meets the NABERS requirement, NABERS, and their energy efficiency standards. And then beyond that, I've got some questions around the infrastructure with respect to active transport, cycling and shared paths, things like that.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the planning scheme unfortunately doesn't have any specifications about energy efficiency of the buildings. The applicant has made comments about their approach to reduce environmental impact through energy efficiency. Energy efficiency will be considered at the building permit stage, and off the top of my head, I don't recall what the requirement is for the commercial building, but it'll be dealt with under building. It is something we would like to see in the planning scheme to get more solid and better outcomes, but at this stage it's very weak in that area, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor, the question now is about parking, and is it deemed sufficient that... So there's obviously a lot of changes to parking that are happening in the Kingston CBD as it is, and this proposal will, one way or another, impact parking provisions. Are we confident that the amount of parking that's being provided by the proposal will be sufficient, and will it have impact on the rest of the community who, I think, are at the moment reeling from the some of the proposed changes and reductions in the number of parking spots available in the Kingston CBD?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, two matters there. One is about the impacts of parking more generally. It's not for consideration in this planning application. That would be for council to consider and how they're going to deal with parking in the area. This particular application has met its requirements for the car parking provisions as stipulated by the planning scheme, and the parking provisions include the requirements for on-site bicycle parking and the requirements for that as well.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. I'm looking now at page 91 and F, where it says there are interactive spaces proposed both at the corner of Goshawk Way and the Huon Highway, that is balcony, and the Goshawk Way frontage, brackets, cafe, retail. When we talk about interactive spaces, to what extent is a balcony interactive?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, generally it's to do with whether there's movement or opportunity of movement and passive surveillance that can occur from those areas. So it's trying to avoid blank walls. So interactive can also be where you have shop windows and you can see the comings and goings and the activity that occurs, and it's certainly encouraged over either glazing that is frosted or covered, as some premises do, or having blank walls.
Thank you. And through you, Mayor, I just wanted to point out in my contribution that when we look at the central business zoned land, the implementation strategy includes design features that should enhance the visual appeal of the proposed developments. This could include iconic gateway developments on corners and a continuous two to three storey built form at the street level in between, with upper levels set back to reduce visual impact. This is one of those proposals where I think it will ultimately provide greater investment in the Kingston CBD, and it will set a hopefully positive precedent for good economic development and sustainable economic development. But that's why it's so crucial that the precedent that it sets does include things like good energy rating, that it's passive thermal solar design, that it includes those things that minimise its impact on the environment, and also that when we're attracting investment to the Kingston CBD, we do it by setting a good example for what the built environment should look like. And that's why, despite the fact that it doesn't fall within the purview of this particular report, that's why it's so crucial that Kingston Park and the Kingston CBD in general are made whole by having separated cycle lanes, much improved public transport, and that's why I've advocated for the provision of free public transport as well. And this is what I guess this proposal, one of the reasons why I'm supporting it, is that we are going to try and set a good example for what the built environment should and could look like. As the population increases in Kingborough, we want investment to take place in a way that is environmentally sustainable and that leaves no one behind. So that's why I'm pleased to support it. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Are there further speakers? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I also would like to add my contribution and start by again thanking the council staff for the way in section 2.5 they addressed all the community's concerns and just went through forensically and frankly helped educate the community as to why you've made your decisions. Their concerns have been heard, and it's really good for the community to read the feedback, which they may not always get. And I think it helps set the stage for the community to understand that this is actually a good thing for Kingborough. This is a good development. My personal opinion is aesthetically it looks nice. I believe the curved lines, I mean, this it's not about architecture, what do I know, but, you know, I know my area and I know what it feels like to drive down the outlet and enter my area. As soon as I come home from being in Hobart all day, my spirits lift because you just love that outlook as you come into that leafy green Kingborough area. And I think this complements it. I think it's going to allow a reduction in commutes for a lot of people. It's going to lift the economy of the area. And I fully support it, and I really do appreciate the way Council's been quite forensic in the way that they have addressed the community's concerns. So I'm happy to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Antolli. Ms Tullamore.
Sorry. Just through you, Mayor, I just wanted to make it clear that the planning assessment was done by a planning consultant in this instance. As much as I'd love to take the credit, they did use our template, but just to make it clear, because of the partnership project, an independent planner was used to make the assessment and recommendations.
Thank you, Ms Tullamore. I was going to make that point for those new councillors. When we do make an assessment, when there's a development application for anything to do with Kingston Park, because we own the land and we were in a partnership with Traders in Purple, we do require an independent consultant to make the assessment so that we can't be accused of having any bias in relation to that. Are there any further contributions? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. I was speaking in favour of the recommendation, and I think from my point of view it's worth saying that for a project of this size to have so few conditions attached to it is a great result. So well done to all those involved.
Thank you. Are there further speakers? I just wanted to make some comments then before I ask Councillor Gladewright to close the debate. I think that this is a very exciting proposal for Kingborough, and if you consider the fact that we now have over 40,000 residents and our projected population increase is significant going to the next 20 or 30 years, then we do need commercial developments such as this that will enable businesses and offices to set up further here in Kingborough. And of course, the more that do, we need the facilities for it, but that will hopefully then reduce the congestion on the southern outlet as less people will need to travel into the CBD of Hobart for their work. So I think that this is, I guess, for some people, and we've seen that come through in the representations, for some people they don't want to see a building of this height. I understand that, but it does meet the planning scheme, and I believe it meets the future requirements of Kingborough as a municipality of significant growth. So I look forward to this proceeding, and I thank all the councillors for their contributions. Councillor Gladewright, did you want to sum up? No? Thank you. I'm going to put the motion. It is as moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. The time being nearly 7:20 or 7:15, according, depending on which clock you're looking at, I'm going to call a short recess because we've still got a few things that we need to go through. So can we be back here by the real clock, which is mine, which would say 7:25, as opposed to the one up there, which is incorrect. So you've got 9 minutes. So for those watching along at home, we're just going to have a short comfort break and then we'll be back. All good. I'm recording back on. Thank you. Welcome back. Thank you to those people watching at home for your patience. When we have a particularly long meeting, we just need a little bit of a comfort break to regroup. So what I failed to say before we... Oh, no, I did say it. Planning open session. Right. Or maybe I didn't say it and Mrs. Morton just wrote it in, but we did adjourn. So open session of council now resumes at 7:25 p.m. We're on page 145, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned. Still on page 145, at the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. We move now to the financial report for February 2023 with a recommendation on page 147, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Hello, wake up. Anybody? Come on. The Deputy Mayor's been moving everything tonight. Councillor Cordova, thank you. And seconded Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. We're looking at the financial report, and essentially the I might start by asking if there's anything particularly alarming within the report, because I don't think there is. But over to through you, Mayor. Are we solvent?
I'll hand over to the Chief Financial Officer and current reigning champion of the bowls thing, Mr. Breen.
Through you, Mayor. Yeah, look, I'll just refer to the financials, which are on page 154. Look, essentially, it's been a fairly difficult year so far. You know, we're 8 months into the year now. Most larger organisations or all organisations, we've been impacted by inflation and the impacts of inflation. So that's certainly played a part in the expected result for the year. So while we're looking to have a break-even result, in essence, at this stage, looking like about a $330,000 underlying deficit, and that's basically on the back of significant impacts from inflation and also some costs associated with rain events that we've seen in the past 8 months.
Thank you, and I think it's worth noting also rates are $267,000 over budget, primarily due to the receipt of supplemental rates in the 3 months from September to November. I found it interesting that user fees are $86,000 over budget due to greater than expected income from the sports centre and the community hub, and turf rental income, which is up $34,000 from the cricket ground usage due to the Twin Ovals being used as a training venue for the ICC World Cup. That's all for me. I look forward to other councillors' contribution. Thanks.
Thank you. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just had a question on the underlying deficit forecast. I think it's increased about $100,000 from January to the February report. And I gather that's down to maybe the annual leave entitlements not being taken up as much as forecast, and wondering, could we get more information on that?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. So essentially over the past couple of years, when COVID started to have an impact on council, we saw a trend for annual leave to be taken primarily over the January-February period, and that was certainly occurred in the past 2 years. This year the trend hasn't been the same, and there's been a significant reduction in the amount of leave taken in January and February. One assumption would be that perhaps people are now, with the ability to perhaps conduct some international travel, are stockpiling their leave and will take leave more around the middle of the year as opposed to the January-February period, when it's advantageous to holiday in Tasmania. So I'd say that's probably the impact. We may see a little bit more leave around the Easter period, school holidays, those sort of things, so April, but certainly $50,000 impact we've seen from that this financial year.
Councillor Bain? No, any further? No, Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. I apologise I didn't send this question earlier with some notice, but can I be reminded, what was the forecast result predicted when we set the long-term financial plan in 2022?
Mr. Breen. Through you, Mayor. So if I understand the question right, what was the underlying surplus?
Yes.
So it was basically break-even, $20,000. So it was essentially a break-even result for the year.
Thank you.
Councillor Dean.
That's what I just wanted to point out. I guess from my perspective, it's not like we've gone from a massive forecast surplus down to 330 than it was. You know, it's not a huge... Well, it's still a deficit. But I just wanted to make that point. And I guess just a general point from your expertise, it is kind of nice we rate ourselves as a council in terms of our financial and fiscal responsibility. Looking elsewhere, how does that rate at this point of the year, looking at other similar sized councils around the state?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. I know a number of councils are experiencing the same difficulties that we are. So inflation impacts on areas like our materials, contracts, petrol, things like that, where there's and parts. So I think we're all going to be in a similar sort of bucket. Some councils are a little bit better off financially in terms of their rates revenue, and so have a bit more a capacity to be able to handle that those sort of impacts. But generally, we're certainly all feeling it. And I'd expect all councils to have their expenditure above budget.
General Manager, would just like to add a comment.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Dean, late last week I was talking to a number of colleagues from the north and northwest of the state, as well as general managers from some of the smaller councils, and one of the impacts that they're experiencing that we haven't had yet is that they haven't been able to get tenders for their construction contracts. So a few of the councils have now resorted to providing a 12-month window for a project that they put out to tender just to get a tender received.
Any further comments? No? If not, Councillor Cordova, did you want to sum up? Thank you. I'll put the motion then, moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Fox, that Council endorses the attached financial report as at the 28th of February 2023. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. We turn now to page 169, Notice of Motion. Councillor Cordova has submitted a notice of motion headed Roadkill Mitigation Strategy. We also have a response there from Ms Quinn. Councillor Cordova, you'll be moving that, and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. So we have before us a proposal to implement and develop, or develop and then implement, a roadkill mitigation strategy. Obviously, any prepared roadkill mitigation strategy would have to come back before the council for its endorsement. However, I wanted to get the ball rolling on this idea. As it says in the background of the report, according to analysis, Kingston specifically has the highest rate of wildlife vehicle collisions in the state of Tasmania. And when you talk with tourists or with people from the mainland, often you'll hear anecdotes about how people really regard Tasmania as essentially being the roadkill capital of the world. Obviously, that's somewhat to do with the fact that we have an abundance of wildlife, but it also speaks to the grave problem with driver behaviour and the fact that we have so many rural roads and that people just aren't slowing down from dusk till dawn, which would go a long way to mitigate some of the harm that's caused. The estimates vary, but it could be between 500,000 and 1 million animals are dying on Tasmanian roads each year. Now, this council acknowledges that we are in a climate change and biodiversity emergency and that we have in place strategies to avoid that, or to minimise, adapt and be more resilient to it. In Tasmania, we are lucky to have the native wildlife that we do. It is precious and it does need our protection. To continue with a status quo approach, I think, is not only inhumane, but also it actually is inefficient. And the reason I say that is because as we analyse our budgets, and indeed we're coming up to budget time now, you'll note that across the various departments of council, we do have in various different line items roadkill clean-up costs that are being assorted to different departments. So it's one of those things where if you nip it in the bud, if you reduce the overall number of wildlife vehicle collisions, then it will go a long way to reducing the costs that are associated with that. And when I talk about the costs, I've alluded to the costs that council directly feels, but of course there's so many more costs experienced in the community, whether it is property damage or physical harm. And I've regaled this council with the story of me nearly losing it whilst driving down near Melton Mowbray, nearly hitting a deer. We have deer in this municipality, and to my knowledge, there's been 68 vehicle collisions with deer that we are aware of so far. These things are life and death, really, when it comes to hitting a deer. But even when you're hitting wallaby or possum or patermelon, It is it can be absolutely devastating for human life, but of course it's just tragic for the suffering, the really untold suffering that we're seeing. If you talk to people from Bonorong or indeed the group who we joined by from WACT, they will tell you about the suffering that goes on when wildlife is not when wildlife is hit by cars, and often it takes a long time for those animals to perish. There is no easy solution. There is no single easy fix, but we do know that there have been recommendations made, including improving signage that provides phone numbers for roadkill removal or wildlife care, better monitoring and publication of roadkill statistics, longer-term funding of wildlife care and networks, and improving access to care facilities have also been suggested to improve animal welfare outcomes. There are things that we can do, and I think fundamentally the question will come from this discussion about, do we have an accurate picture of roadkill costs within Kingborough, and what is the most effective way of reducing the harm, both to people and to animals, that is caused by roadkill in Kingborough? Would it be useful to know more than we currently know? Would it be helpful to have a strategy whereby Kingborough can act as a leader within the state and within southern councils to galvanise action from the state government and work more closely with other councils to mitigate this clear harm? We know that it costs us anywhere up to $7 billion per year around the country, and somewhere between $17.6 and $21 million annually just in property damage and human injuries alone, according to NRMA, from their Wildlife Road Safety Report. This is a clear and present risk to the residents of our municipality. To do nothing would be to fly in the face of our own strategic plan, which specifically acknowledges our biodiversity emergency. I think the question now that we will discuss is what's the best way of doing it, but I think we all admit that we have to do something. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further contributions? Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Dean, and then Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to thank Councillor Cordova for raising this matter. It has been something that many members of our community have written to me, and unfortunately in Howden on a daily basis that I actually have to see. But it's important we have this conversation tonight and debate and understanding the matters from council, and I thank the officers' responses, and I have a few questions relating to that. I'd also like to thank the work of the many wildlife protection groups in Tasmania, and particularly the group that has been working with council on some of these matters and in contact with us as councillors, the wildlife community together volunteers, who donate so many of their hours actually looking after injured wildlife, many from road accidents. And as Councillor Cordova has said, you know, reducing roadkill is also not just one of the issues of conserving animals and reducing animal suffering, but it's a critical public safety prevention measure. Road accidents caused by drivers swerving to avoid animals can be fatal at worst, and most commonly are damaging to people and vehicles. And I guess as councillors, it's important to reflect with the high numbers of tourists that are visiting Bruny Island. It's something we definitely need to keep in mind. And perhaps if this is not just foreshadowing, if it doesn't get passed tonight, perhaps in the future we could look at certain hotspot areas and work with maybe the state government, and Bruny Island would definitely be a place for that, because not only we have local tourists, interstate tourists, but international tourists as well. And the unsightly, I don't know if anybody ever has cycled to Bruny Island, but cycling and roadkill as well is another matter, and it's very disturbing. And when I first came to Tasmania 25 years ago, I remember that as a particular memory of cycling from Conyngham to Cloudy Bay, and I just could not believe the amount of roadkill that I saw then, and I'm sure that that has totally increased. So, as Councillor Cordova has mentioned, like if not now, when? Who will do this? Do we know what other councils are doing in this area? Members of Wildlife Together have mentioned that Huon Council's interest in looking at a strategy, Brighton Council, perhaps Circular Head, doing their work around devils. Have we spoken to these councils to see what they are doing and perhaps working on a strategy together?
Ms. Corinne. Question.
Through you, Mayor. I guess we are talking to other councils all the time about what they're doing in the nature conservation space. In terms of roadkill specifically, it's not something that that we have for a while, and I think there'd be great benefit in a knowledge sharing forum, either in the southern region or the state would be even better, and I think that's something that our council as officers we could advocate for, that there's more knowledge sharing about what the different groups are doing and what has worked and what hasn't worked. So I think there's been, as you can probably see from my response, I think it's really important that whatever we invest in, that we do that on a sound basis where we've made sure that it's going to work and there's data there. So something else that as officers we're doing at the moment, two things. One of them is contacting other councils across Australia and state governments who have used virtual fencing, which we've talked about previously, to see how the data is for that, because in Tasmania it had very mixed results depending on the type of road and the volume of traffic and the speed of the traffic on that road. So, and the other thing we're looking at is wildlife crossings, overpasses and underpasses, and how state government and councils have funded those, designed them, and trying to collect a whole lot of information about that as well.
Thank you. It's really great to see what staff initiatives and what you've been doing and the work behind the scene. And I guess a strategy really formalises that work and puts something into practice. But I note that there's comments about the time that this would take away from staff from actually doing the actions. So I guess we've passed recently a housing commitment. Would a road kill, say, mitigation commitment or something be of less time consuming for officers versus, say, the longer that has mentioned here in regards to a lengthy strategy? I mean, I will support this tonight, but I'm just thinking, would a commitment perhaps, because I guess you are doing things already, would that then the community, I guess, then can see, and our advocates can see that council is actually doing something, and we won't keep asking questions, that we can actually look to the point that actually council is doing this, this and this, and we have a commitment to work with other councils and things like that. Just wondering, through Mayor Staff's, Ms Quinn's response on that one.
Thank you. Ms Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. Yeah, I did allude to it in my response, and I'd like to talk to it again, the point about prioritisation. So the natural areas and biodiversity team prioritises our workload every year, looking at the threatening processes to fauna and wildlife and the assets that we're there to protect. So our program is prioritised, and what I would caution against is putting something new into that mix of prioritisation. So roadkill is there as a threat to wildlife, and it's prioritised based on what we understand its level of threat is to wildlife in Kingborough. And so for every threat that's out there, whether it be pollution, climate change, weeds, it could be anything, inappropriate fire regimes, we've gone through and thought about and strategically prioritised our actions. So I think it's important to be mindful, whether we're talking about a strategy or a statement, that we need to make sure that we're doing that in a prioritised way and not reacting to one issue and another. And I'm no way taking away from the issue of what roadkill has on Tasmania's wildlife, and acknowledge the work that people are doing in that space and that we do. So we are not doing nothing, and I'm not suggesting you've said that. As officers, we are... We do take action on roadkill, but it is a difficult issue because there isn't a lot of evidence that different strategies work, and they're expensive, and the road network is owned both by council and the state. So, yes, we could potentially write a statement. I would ask you as councillors to consider what would that do, and would we then write a statement, or do we need to write a statement about all of those threatening processes that are occurring in the conservation space?
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Just in the first line of officer's response, council has been working on strategies to reduce the death of wildlife on the council road network. I guess that term strategies, and I think you've mentioned the different things that council are working on. I guess when you've talked about what you've just mentioned, or the areas that officers are doing, calling interstate and that sort of thing. Is that what you're meaning in that comment there?
Ms Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, but also more concrete, the concrete things we're doing, which is using signage on our roads, collecting carcasses in urban areas and removing those from roads to prevent secondary kill. We've used variable messaging boards around in spring, particularly around devil hotspots. So one of our key focuses through our roadkill mitigation work are those threatened species. So and they're often lesser, but they're certainly there. So roadkill is a threatening process in the state recovery plans for both devils and quolls. So we do tend to use the hotspot data that's collected through the roadkill apps to look at where those spaces are in Kingborough and look at variable messaging for those signs. We've also supported the community groups who are interested in this issue as well, and to help promote their issues.
Thank you. I guess moving forward, you know, we could keep going on at council meetings and asking questions about what council's doing in this area, but yet if it was stated in the document, strategy or a commitment or something, then we can clearly have an outline in regards to what council is doing, because we know you're doing fantastic work and thank you very much for that. But I can see it written down there. Community members, our animal advocate groups can see that it's actually written down, and we can see that council is working towards something. And then I guess also it could have in there something about, you know, that we will work with other councils. Perhaps it could be an action to, you know, raise this at LGAT to ensure that, so the Local Government Association, for our people in the audience and listening, to see that, you know, we're advocating for a strategic approach for government, that we're talking with state government, that I guess it just gives us an outline of things that we're working towards. And I can see that you're doing something, so I'm not going to keep asking questions. Different community groups can see, and perhaps as well, it doesn't all have to fall under council, all of the strategies and actions that come out of some commitment or strategy, that, you know, the Wildlife Together volunteers, they've collected data and research, they've got UTAS PhD people working on new technologies and things like that, so we're ensuring that we're keeping up to date with those things. And many of the wildlife volunteers as well would be happy to give up, they've said in emails, they'd be happy to give up their time voluntarily to you know, work with council to develop this and actually put these things into place. So on the principle, I think it is a good idea to have something written down because we are doing things anyway. So that's why I'm supporting this motion tonight, and it is a really important matter.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Dean.
Again, look, I acknowledge the intent from Councillor Court over here in wanting to reduce the amount of roadkill in Kingborough, absolutely. But again, like in recent times, if I'm not going to support your motion, I think it warrants an explanation. And I think to lend to where I'm going in terms of why I won't be supporting this, I guess is fairly clearly stated in the officer's response, and I think the response is actually quite thorough and excellent from the Manager of Environmental Services. And I think in the answers that you give, not just to Councillor Midgley just now, but beyond on the matters of environmental, are so appreciated, and the way you explain things helps me greatly. So I really thank you in how you go about answering all the questions that we send your way. But I just want to, I guess, in supporting my stance, it's quite clear here that the officer's response states that roadkill will be addressed as part of the natural areas and biodiversity strategy being developed for council, and it is more efficient to deal with the issue as one of the many threats facing wildlife to allow for a prioritised and coordinated approach. And further below that, I quote, the development of a roadkill mitigation strategy would divert resources away from this program. At the same time, I do don't want to take away from Councillor Midgley's comments about whether it would be in our interest to provide some kind of statement. That in itself I'm not against, having previously hopefully preparing a statement around housing, just to make it explicitly clear what it is that we are doing. So I think that's part of the issue here, is that it might be that the community doesn't see necessarily, but when you hear the discussion from you and also from Councillor Midgley, there is so much that we are doing, and potentially, in terms of the background statement there, it's clear that, yes, Kingston has a high rate of wildlife vehicle collisions, but I don't know that, as you've previously alluded to, Manager of Environmental Services, that this isn't necessarily because we are worser drivers in Kingborough, but it's just the nature of where we live and what's happening here unique to Kingborough. So I think those points are the ones why I won't be supporting it, but I'm not saying that moving forward, whether there is something that we might be able to do to ease or reassure the community, I suppose, that we are doing quite a lot in this space, regardless if it's not written down explicitly.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Next I had Councillor Fox and then Councillor Bain. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I agree with Councillor Dean's comments. I think it does concern me that if we were to be putting time and effort into writing strategies, that we're not, the resources that we have in this area will not be efficiently used, and it's not the best bang for our buck, basically. But at the same time, I realise that this is a very emotional and visible issue on our roads, and heartrending to both adults and children to see the amount of roadkill on our roads. And I think it's important that we promote in our communications to the media that what we do, so that people know that we are doing something. We as councillors are only just becoming aware of how much work is being done in this area, and it's important that we communicate that, and also that we work, as is already happening, on a regional and statewide basis, so that we can understand more about the data of the effectiveness of the work that we are doing. That's probably the most important part, and no strategy is really going to provide that information for us. I've always been very passionate about this issue. In fact, I think I was probably the first councillor that raised this in council as being something we must do and do something about, and removing the carcasses, as we already do, monitoring them and removing them as soon as possible is one of the best things to do, because it doesn't add to the burden of more animals coming to eat those victims and then being hit again and again, and it becomes a sink for our wildlife. So I think we are doing our best, and we should continue to do what we are doing, but promote it to the community. But I won't be supporting the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you to the Manager of Environmental Services for an excellent response, which I think highlights lots of things that we are doing. And I just have a question on the very last sentence where it says feedback to councillors and the community about the implementation of strategies to reduce roadkill will be reported in departmental activity reports and social media posts. Is that implying that it will be done, or it already is happening?
I think it says part of the natural areas biodiversity strategy, but Ms Klein can talk to that.
Through you, Mayor, what I meant by that sentence, just to clarify, is that you might be familiar that we do activity reports quarterly to council, and in those activity reports we detail what we've been working on, and so anything we do in this roadkill space we would have reported in the past, and we will continue to report. So that's I guess I was highlighting that's the main way that councillors would find out about what we're doing in this space, is through those reports.
Councillor Bain, do you have anything further? No. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I have a question, Mayor. As Councillor Dean has said, looking at the natural areas biodiversity strategy, that will be addressed in there. I guess I'd like to understand what that would look like, please.
Ms Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. So you might be familiar, the natural areas and biodiversity area has lots of plans. A lot of them are reserve management plans that we work on, but we don't have an overarching strategy for our unit. So we have prioritised threats and actions and work plans, but we haven't got that higher level strategy document that outlines what we're going to do. So we've been working slowly on it behind all of our other priorities, and it's due next year. So that would look at all of the issues that are facing biodiversity and conservation in Kingborough that are in Council's remit, and prioritise actions about what are our key strategies for addressing those, what are the resources, and what are the actions that are going to flow from that.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley.
Just further on that question, so I guess in regards to roadkill mitigation, what would be, because you've noted that, sorry, through you, Mayor, Ms Quinn has noted, the officer has noted that it would be addressed as part of that. I guess, yeah, what would be addressed as part of that in regards to this motion?
Ms Quinn. Through you, Mayor. What I imagine is going to be in there would be, so it would outline what is the issue of roadkill in Kingborough, what is it as a threatening process, what's the scope of it and what's the severity of it. So we'd be rating that and against all of the other issues that are there that impact wildlife. So we'd get some idea about how serious an issue is roadkill for wildlife in Kingborough. That would be one of the outcomes, so we could rank things. But it would also look at what those actions are, and as I said, we've done a lot of them already. So it would be looking at both actions which affect driver behaviour in terms of signage and education campaigns and things, and also those physical strategies like virtual fencing and underpasses and overpasses and the things that help animals to either keep off the road or to cross the road safely.
Further contributions? Councillor Gladright.
Thank you, Mayor. Councillor Cordova, what your motion is asking for is a very specific strategy. Ms Quinn has detailed that they're developing the Natural Areas and Biodiversity Strategy, which is a more holistic approach to this subject. So I can't support your motion, but it doesn't mean that I'm not empathetic to what you're trying to achieve. Of course, roadkill is very devastating. When I lived up Summerlees Road, it was really in your face daily, the amount of roadkill that's happening up there, and I know that's been identified as a hotspot. But given that the staff aren't in support of your recommendation, I can't support this, but I feel comfortable that staff are addressing this issue in that more holistic strategy.
Further discussion? Before I hand back to Councillor Cordova, I'd just like to make a couple of comments. Firstly, to thank Councillor Cordova for bringing this motion to us today so that we can have the discussion about what it is that we are doing already and what we could potentially do in the future. It is obviously an issue that concerns many people, and I would like to, like others have, acknowledge the many people in the community who do volunteer their time, many hundreds of hours of time, to look after the orphaned animals and so on. And I have great respect for people who do that. And I think as a community we should be very thankful that those people are volunteering their time to do that. I find roadkill just awful. It's horrible. I don't think it's any of us would like seeing roadkill. And I think, as has been pointed out in here, one of the reasons why we have so much roadkill is we also have so much wildlife in Kingborough. And in one hand, that's something we can be incredibly grateful for. But, of course, a whole range of factors, including development, have meant that the chances of an animal actually being hit by a car increases as our population grows. I do think that it would be optimal if we could take a regional approach or a statewide approach, because I don't see the point of us having a strategy for just our area when we have other adjacent municipalities. And I think collectively, if we were to look at this issue and also lobby the state government, because let's not forget that, of course, there are state roads and also federal government roads, and there may be that there's funding available within some of the numerous grant programs across state or federal government to actually collectively work on a project here. I think that we are in a very difficult position. I mean, we've just looked at the financial report for council till the end of February 2023, and that tells us that we're
in a far worse position than we had anticipated in our original budget that we set for this year. And we've heard from the Manager of Environmental Services that they are quite stretched in terms of the work that they are doing already. And it always makes me nervous that we are requiring more and more of our staff with things that we would like to advance. And so I do think we need to give some recognition to the advice that we've received from the team that would otherwise be tasked with preparing this strategy. And I think that we already have some work going on in this area with the Natural Areas and Biodiversity Strategy. So I don't feel like we're not addressing this, but I would suggest. So I can't support the motion as it is at the moment because I think we are doing some of the work. But I do want to say very strongly that what I think we should do is pass a motion in the future that provides a recommendation to a future LEGAT meeting where we then ask all councils to support it so that we go collectively and say to the state government that we would like to have a statewide approach to looking at what we can do. It seems that driver behaviour is such a big part of this, and so we do need to involve different agencies and different authorities, the Tourism Authority, but Tasmania Police and a whole range of different agencies. So I think it is a wider approach that we need, and I would be very supportive of a LEGAT motion where we try and ask the state government to provide some assistance and look at what we can do right across our state, because whilst it'd be nice to be an absolute leader in this area, I think that we can achieve more if we group together and try and resolve this situation. So thank you, Councillor Cordova, for bringing this, and would you like to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. And I appreciate my colleagues' contributions. Wildlife crossing, I think we've established that wildlife crossing roads is not something that stops at municipal borders. I think we, from this discussion, we've very much established that on the border of Kingborough and Huon, you know, in Huon they've got the problem, in Hobart they've got the problem, so a larger approach is needed. And so I think we do know that we need a statewide approach to this issue, and a LEGAT motion now seems to be on the cards, which I think would be a positive outcome from this discussion. I'd be happy to see that outcome, although I know that LEGAT motions have a habit of taking forever to materialise or for LEGAT to kind of do anything. But having said that, roadkill is a threat to wildlife. But importantly, something I tried to paint a picture of in my contribution is that it's a threat also to humans and property, and it comes with enormous social costs each year in the millions in Tasmania, and there will be some people living in Kingborough whose lives have dramatically changed due to hitting a wallaby at the wrong place at the wrong time, and it can be devastating. So currently, what we've established is that we are doing a lot as a council, but the question remains that I flagged at the beginning. Do we have specific, measurable, achievable, relevant and time-bound targets with relation to the specific issue of roadkill? It's one thing to say we're doing a lot around roadkill mitigation as one aspect of a broader natural areas and biodiversity workload, but my question was about the specific and measurable, achievable, relevant and time-bound issues with relation to roadkill. For example, is it a priority? If it is a priority, let's fund it. How much funding do we need to adequately fund it? Well, maybe a strategy would tell us. We should work together with other tiers of government. Which tiers of government and when, which councils and how? Well, a strategy would lead to this collective action across the councils and would put us in a leadership position, which I think we ought to be, since the problem is demonstrably worse in our municipality. So when determining where and how many variable message boards we should be placing in springtime for devil hotspots, wouldn't a strategy tell us where we should put them and how many and how much more investment we need? I think I want to reiterate, of course, the thanks once again to our staff, to all the local wildlife networks who are helping us with this issue, and of course to the Wildlife and Community Together Tasmania network for all of their work on this as well. We do have to do something. I'm disappointed that it looks like I may not have the numbers tonight to get the action that I so desire on this. However, we are starting to establish that discussion, and I will continue to bring this back to council as necessary and find a way forward, whether that's a legat motion or otherwise, that we can all agree to, because I think we all owe it to the wildlife and to the residents and tourists across Kingborough to take action. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I will put the motion now as printed in the agenda. It's moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
Okay, a show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Cordova and Midgley. Those against? Is Councillors Antoli, Fox, Dean, Bain, Richardson, Street, Glade Wright and Reet. The motion is lost. Where are we up to? I've just got to turn my page. Okay, we're on page 171. Confirmation of minutes... Sorry, beg your pardon. Confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. We have confirmation of minutes and applications for leave of absence. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. In accordance with the Kingborough Council meetings audio recording guidelines policy, recording of the open session of Council will now cease. So I say thank you very much to all those people who have joined us this evening, both in the public gallery and also who have been watching along at home on YouTube. Good evening. We have adjourned that section of the meeting at 8:06 p.m.